G'day, g'day. Welcome back to the Sports Medicine Project. We have a very good episode coming today with Dr. Chad Cook. Full episode goes for about 70 minutes. Pretty eye-opening episode for someone like myself who doesn't do a lot of manual therapy, but has definitely been a part of the argument and followed it online and tried to read as much as I can about it. Very, very interesting, and good to see that I was wrong plenty of time, as you'll see in this episode. But before we get to that, welcome to my co-host, Kelly Kortik. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm really sad that I missed this episode. I was up home for the weekend, so wasn't able to attend because I was actually on my flight back to Newcastle. So I am very excited that this episode is getting released nice and early from when it was recorded so that I can listen to it straight away. Because yeah, as soon as I got home, Blake was like, oh, you wait until you listen to this episode, like there's so many good things that you're going to take away from it. And I'm interested in getting proven wrong in a lot of ways that I'm sure I have been sort of certain that I know what I'm talking about in the past, but maybe I need to reconsider that.
Yeah, definitely. Now, before we get to that, just a little bit of housekeeping. This week on our Patreon, which will have the link below, we have a couple of things coming out. We have a video case study with real pictures and videos, and Kelly and I are both going through and talking about the clinical reasoning with a case of a distal lateral foot pain, which is quite interesting and a little bit more unique and probably not that more common for people to see. Our plyometric video will be out on the weekend as well, which is a follow-up to our plyometric podcast that we did. And then also we have I'm doing a research review. Hopefully, if I can get a copy of the study, hopefully looking at the benefit of exercise for ankle osteoarthritis and big toe osteoarthritis, which is pretty interesting. So link below, sign up. It is less than a small coffee a week, which I think is pretty good value. What can you, do you know anything that's less than
a week or a month?
No, a week. A month, depending on where you go. If you go to Merriweather Blue Door, it could be worth a coffee a month. They're pretty expensive in there. Mm. If you get oat milk and if you get the extra large, which is about the size of a large McDonald's cup. It's huge, that thing.
Yeah, that is large. Sometimes because on instinct, I'll order a large because that's what I usually order. And then they'll give me that and I'm like, oh, this is a big commitment.
Yeah, I'll be paying for it. You either go one way where you're just rattled for the day or you just go so high then you fall asleep. I've made the mistake of having that and then a second coffee. And you just slowly go downhill into a slope until you end up on the lounge napping. Yeah. So the podcast today with Dr. Chad Cook, pretty interesting guy. I mean, you guys probably would have heard of him before. I think he's probably most well known from people that I've spoken to, the podcast that he did with Adam Eakins and Jared Powell on the Shoulder Physio podcast, which is where I first heard him. And the way that he comes across is the model of clinician that I want to be. He just has nothing bad to say about anyone or their opinion. He just presents his information and why and the evidence, you know, mixed around his clinical experience. And it was just so refreshing to hear, especially in this world of social media where it's my thing's better than yours, my treatment's way better. It was really just great.
I'm keen you mentioned that.
Yeah, and I don't use a lot of manual therapy anyway in clinical practice. I think, I guess one of the learnings even from the podcast was the things that I probably focus on, which is a lot more, I would say, education and trying to help people understand, you know, what's happening to them and what they can do and how we can work together to get them to where they're wanting to go. But it was interesting to hear his point of view of, it seems like that way isn't superior, and I don't always think that it is. But being able to do that is incredibly difficult, and we don't really know how to do that well because it takes years to develop your communication skills. And that way may not be or isn't superior to any other way, which is potentially the more biomechanical approach and the manual therapy approach.
I'm not sure you've sold me on that yet. I'll have to listen to his argument.
To a degree, like he's a big believer in the narrative around what we're doing manual therapy wise. An interesting one that I'm going to use, which I really like, is him explaining manual therapy a bit like an ibuprofen for this particular sore spot or particular sore muscle group or body part or joint, which I really like. And I kind of think it's similar with Shockwave or even like a heel lift or a cushion chew or even some tape, which was good. But he said some stuff about the mechanisms as well, where there's plenty of research on what we think is happening manual therapy wise. And I forgot to tell you this as well. He agreed about the whole idea of resistance training being probably something that a lot of people should do. And he was speaking about on a cellular level or an inflammatory level, one of the levels in the body that manual therapy does not seem to influence, but resistance training does seem to influence. So it's something that potentially is a pretty broad recommendation. It's probably a safe recommendation that most people should be doing some form of resistance training.
Does he still recommend manual therapy as an adjunct to some form of exercise therapy or education or something
yeah.
else though?
Yeah, yeah. And he says this in so many podcasts, and it sounds so logical and something we have always spoken about. The argument and the debate is always one versus the other. What is better? Is it squats or is it dry needling or is it pain neuroscience education or is it orthotic therapy?
Why can't we have both?
And it's like, well, it's a combination of everything and it's tailoring to the person in front of you. But yeah, he also quotes this awesome study where they looked overseas, and he was saying he was jealous of the people who got to do the study. They looked at maybe 50 or 100,000 clinicians, and they looked at their treatment signature, which is a cool phrase to use, but they tried to work out what treatments and what practitioners were getting the best outcomes and the best results overall, and it was the people that could adapt their treatment, and that might be a higher percentage of manual therapy or a lower percentage, but the people that didn't get the best outcomes were the people that were completely rigid, didn't adapt and didn't change to that person where they are. And that might be in the acute phase of pain or the medium term or the long term as well.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm keen to listen to it and hear
it. And then we talked about exercise compliance as well, which that is difficult. Like we really didn't go superficial. We tried to go as deep as possible because I had so many questions on like, what do you think? Because I don't know about you, but the two things that I think I do struggle with the most as a clinician is communication and having people understand why I'm saying what I'm saying and why I'm recommending what I'm recommending, and then compliance all the way to the long term and then post after that. Because there's plenty of studies to say that people just stop as soon as their pain's gone.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, you hear that all the time, like maybe at the start when someone's got a really painful problem, that's when they're doing their exercises all the time or the recommendation all the time, and then it just sort of drops off. And this is also why I wonder how dietitians go. Like that must be such a hard profession, because at least patients come into us because they're motivated by pain. In working as a dietitian, when there's not that motivator, it must be really hard, I think, to try and keep people and patients engaged.
Oh, definitely. I mean, one of the factors that we know has a really big influence over people is if you're able to modulate their pain then and there or in the short term, that does a whole lot for their understanding of what's happening, their cognitive health, and just their buy-in to what you're trying to help them do. And I guess the dietitians wouldn't have that benefit. It takes longer than what most pain conditions or acute pain would take to settle down.
Yeah, it'd be really challenging, I think.
And we talked a lot about the psychological research as well, and he called it the psychological revolution is a term I heard him coin. And you know, the panacea that we thought that was going to be potentially isn't. It's definitely helpful, but it doesn't seem to outperform anything else. And he actually worked with a couple of psychologists, so that was really cool. It was interesting just to hear.
One to reflect on for a while, hey?
Yeah. Well, I haven't been I haven't done much manual therapy. I love being a part of the debate. When I say a part, just watching from a distance. But it really, I think maybe a couple of years ago, a lot of people thought, which he talks about, that it's low value care. Manual therapy is low value care. And then if you were to look to the literature, according to Chad, it performs similar, like exactly the same or better than exercise to a degree. And of course, there's going to be studies which I'm not aware of, where it seems to outperform, but it seems to be every time we add, which is Another thing that he...
I feel like you're giving too much away.
No way. I'm not giving anything away. It was, it was just so many thoughts. It was good. It was a good challenge. And I think this is one of the, those ones that people will definitely get a lot out of. And it will change, which is he's passionate about as well.
I'm keen to... for us to re-record another podcast or record another podcast next week and hear your thoughts on your week of just manual therapying everyone.
Yeah, you were just trying to get away from it. You're sick of hearing me talk about this podcast.
No, I just want to hear it from the source himself rather than...
Yeah, true. I'm just pulling this one liners out from there. Yeah. They're the ones that stood out. Now, you had something that you wanted to tell the listeners about.
I am attending the Women in Sport Congress in March down in Sydney. If anyone's going to the conference, I will be there on the Friday, so let me know. Would love to catch up. But upon signing up and having a look on their website, I realized that they've got a really cool educational platform on there where you can access videos and resources around women's sports. So you can look at adolescent athletes and looking at hormonal contraception and going through puberty and the menstrual cycle and bone health and a bunch of different things. There's videos, there's article references, there's lots of different options for us to just get better informed on treating women and understanding women in sport. So have a look at that. The other thing that I think it could be helpful for is just a resource for our patients if they are interested. It would be a nice thing to be able to direct them in that way. Most of the information is presented by sports physicians and GPs, so it's also quite digestible and easy to understand from even like a patient perspective, I would think. So have a look at that. It's the Women in Sport Congress website. They've got lots of educational videos and things.
Is it designed for clinicians or for patients or for both?
Probably depends. Like if it's not something that you're very familiar with and it's not something that you've educated yourself on, then I'd say that it would be relevant to clinicians. I also think patients could look at it and take a lot away from it as well.
Have you had a look into it?
Yeah, I've watched quite a few.
Is there any infographics or is there any thing that's a bit easier to understand or does it go pretty in detail?
There's both. Like most of it I wouldn't say was particularly new to me, but there is a lot of maybe some of the stuff on like hormonal contraception because that's not an area in terms of like the science around it. And the impacts that it may or may not have in various conditions like treating PCOS and endometriosis and things like that. That's something that I learned a few things about. But I also think that it would be suitable for patients or athletes to check out.
Mm. Another thing on that topic that I think would be good to check out, I did save it. I need to share it over on the Instagram. The BJ Sam, they just come out with a world consensus on Red S and female hormone health, which they had a really cool infographic and a study to go with it, which I think would be a pretty cool read. So that would be another one. I'm pretty sure it's open access. I will share it over on the Instagram. And if I have time, I might even just drop it down in the show notes.
Yeah.
Cool. Enjoy this episode, everybody. But before you go, I need a favor. Calling out everyone that listens to this podcast. Now, we don't have any ads on the podcast purposely because it's not what it's about, but I am asking for something in return. We would benefit and the podcast would benefit if you're able to head to the review, whether you're on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or Google Podcasts or if you listen through the phone or however else you get your podcast, if you could leave us a review only because we're trying to get to 100 and then I will never ask you again. We are on 68, I think, maybe 69. So I would appreciate that. And there is definitely more listeners than that according to our statistics. So we'll definitely appreciate a review only because we want to be able to share this information with more clinicians and more people out there. Enjoy this episode with Dr. Tad Cook, and we will talk to you all next week. Welcome back to the Sports Medicine Project. Now we have another very special international guest joining us today, Dr. Chad Cook, who is all the way over, and he's going to correct me if I'm wrong, all the way over in North Carolina, right next to Duke University. Mate, thank you so much for coming on.
Blake, thanks for inviting me. First of all, I want to say it's a pleasure to be here. You all do a really nice job, so I'm pretty excited. And you are spot on. I am in North Carolina, in the southeast part of the United States.
Very nice. Now, what's the time over there as well? You did mention it before.
So we are in different days. I'm a day before you, but it's 5 p.m. on a Saturday right now.
Yeah, and that's the only thing you would want to be doing with your weekend is talking about physical therapy on a podcast, I'm sure, on a Saturday afternoon.
Well, it's been on the plate all day for sure, and I have
Oh,
a very nice bottle of whiskey waiting for me afterwards. So
that's good. Very
you're in
nice.
between me and whiskey.
Now, I've listened to a lot of your podcasts, and I've followed your work for a while. And as I always try to do for these podcasts, I try to prepare it as much as I could on you and kind of writing down what you've been doing of your 30 plus years in physical therapy. And I've got to admit, it took up a lot of room on my page because you've been a pretty busy person in regards to research and clinical experience, spoken all over the world, spoken on plenty of podcasts. Can you give the listeners an idea of kind of how you got to where you are today and where it all started?
Sure. So I have been a physical therapist for 34 years, and for the first 10, I was a clinician. And just like a lot of us, I had a lot of questions, and I was intrigued. So I got into academia, eventually worked primarily into a research position, which I'm in right now. I'm 75-80% research. I have appointments at three different departments at Duke University, which is a really strong research university. And I think what's unique about me is I've never lost the ability to think like a clinician. So all of my research questions tend to reflect a lot of the same questions I think clinicians have in day-to-day practice.
Yeah, which is easily the one of the most important things. And I guess the frustrations we see with clinicians now is the research question or the research doesn't have any translation to what they're saying in clinical practice. It's important to read and great to be across, but if it's not going to help me with the person in front of me, it's very hard to get that understanding and that buy-in.
Completely agree. You probably are familiar with John Ioannidis's work out of Stanford. He's a, I think he's a clinical epidemiologist, and he said about 85% of the research that comes out is really has no value to a clinical atmosphere, either through flaws or lack of generalizability. So I'm with you there. It's very difficult to do to make your research appropriate for day-to-day practice, but that should be what we strive for.
Do you think that the research that gets done now, like if you were to evaluate two papers, do you think you would have a pretty good idea as to if the researchers that had written each paper were treating patients in the real world? Like you're able to get a pretty good understanding of what kind of, I guess, their conclusions and their recommendations are purely just based off if they are treating patients and seeing people?
Like I do, and one of the first things I look at, and I'm really glad that the tidy air statements came out recently, where you basically have to define what treatment you're doing with a patient in detail, because what we see is a lot of low treatment fidelity, I think, in some of the interventions. In other words, the interventions don't look anything like what we would do in clinical practice or what we would think would be therapeutic. So you end up comparing two faulty interventions, and that's one of the first things I look at. And in many cases, I'll look at a paper and say that's really not going to be appropriate for the patient population that's, similar to mine.
Yeah. Now, I did say this off air as well, but every time I've listened to you speak on a podcast, I don't think you've ever had a bad word or a bad narrative to say about anyone. You're always respectful of the opinion, but still somehow you're able to get your point across. And different to a lot of people, it's very much backed in research first and foremost, but also your clinical experience. Do you have any advice to people? Because especially in this world of social media, it's a lot of you're wrong, I'm right, my treatment's way better than yours. If you're not doing this, you're the worst person on earth. Do you have any advice for people that can sometimes get caught in that trap of trying to argue and debate with people and not really getting anywhere in the end?
So a couple things, I guess. I think for starters, if You really got those two people to communicate. They're probably 80% of what they believe is the same. And we're more similar than we are different in our thoughts. And it's often the extremes that people have arguments over. And I got to tell you, I don't think the world of rehab lives in the extremes. I think we are in the gray. I think it's very clear that our interventions are very similar, that there is no slam dunk gold nugget intervention. And essentially, if we recognize that and we do our best and we always put the patient first, I don't think there would be the arguments that we're seeing on social media. I think social media can be a very corrupt place, a very challenging place. I know a lot of really good people that have really distanced themselves from that because of that, including me. That was my New Year's resolution, get away from social media. And but yeah, I think unfortunately what sells on social media is a lot of extremism, and I don't think that really fits very well in rehab.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I see a lot of on social media is the I guess the made up diagnoses or what you coin and talk about, which I really like when I'm going to start using more, is the over medicalization and the over treatment. And the easy examples to think of, like scapular dyskinesis, misaligned hips. But for me, being in the podiatry world, I see one called like internal rotation syndrome, where everything is about the amount of internal rotation that you have. And I've heard you speak about a story of second impact syndrome, and I'd love for you to kind of tell that story and speak to the listeners what over medicalization is and over treatment, because it's much better terms and I think better understood terms as well.
Yeah, so this is all part of the sociology of medicine, right? And this, where in for some reason over the last several decades, we have divorced ourselves from our own responsibility of our health, and we've given it to others, and those others then have capitalized on that. So over-medicalization or over-treatment is basically doing too much for a condition that generally has a favorable prognosis, and you end up potentially providing harms and costs that are unnecessary for those individuals, but also leading that patient down the wrong path of what type of treatment they should receive. There's a term medicalization, which I think is appropriate here too. And this is the normalization of everyday aches and pains and sadness and things that humans go through. We see this a lot with heavy drug use for depression and anxiety in cases that really aren't clinical diagnoses. And I think what you describe with scapular dyskinesia, which is a great example, right? It's a made-up diagnosis to fit what we see in clinical practice, but in reality, it doesn't have any strong grounding to, what's potentially wrong with that patient. That is very much a medicalization issue. The second impact syndrome that you talk about, what we were very interested in, because there was a lot of hyperbole about it here in the United States. They were scaring everyone. American football was very concerned about getting a second concussion or a second impact syndrome. And we knew that the way that the World Health Organization actually creates a diagnosis, there are four particular components. The first one is that the disease process has to have a unique etiology. The disease process has to have a clear clinical description. You should be able to discriminate it against other disease processes, either through lab work or through other forms of diagnostic testing, imaging, et cetera. And the fourth one, it should have a kind of a predictable trajectory, a medical trajectory. So what we did is we actually studied this, and I think it was 2018. We looked at all of the clinical cases in the literature of second impact syndrome, and we tried to see if it fit the WHO scaffolding for a ICD-9 or ICD-10 diagnosis, and it did not. Essentially, it's kind of a made up term to scare people, but with the idea that it's a second concussion could lead to these really unfavorable conditions in athletes.
What do you think of the idea that, and let's use, scapular dyskinesis as an example, or misaligned hips or anything like that. Do you think the reason that it doesn't really seem to die off is because even if you help someone, or let's say you do treat someone for scapular dyskinesis, your idea is that's the cause of their pain and all the things that you do to treat that, generally will still help someone anyway. So then you kind of have this reoccurring thing. Oh, well, what I did actually did help, and really, in fact, you could have done anything in it, and it could have helped. Is that one of the reasons that you think that people seem to be getting these outcomes, and then the result of that, they go on either social media or create courses or do all these things that say, hey, I've got all this clinical experience where it works, but really it was something else happening in the background?
Yeah, I think people conflate what they see in their clinical examination to the outcomes which occur. And you and I both know that those outcomes can occur from 1,000 different reasons. So there's this misassumption that there's a direct connection there, when in reality, there's not. So I think you were very eloquent in the way that you described that. Absolutely. And because, especially physical therapy, it's as much an art as it is a science, there is still a lot of art that goes into the things that we see and what we feel with their patients. And there's also been very much a lot of theory built up through the years, through the last century. And the science has somewhat caught up with that theory, and we're starting to dispel some of those things that we've traditionally thought.
Yeah, I love this this quote that you say, which I'm definitely going to steal, but I'll definitely make sure to credit you, is when it comes to the kind of manual therapy and treatment world, the pioneers, I guess, were building, sorry, they were building the plane as they were flying it. And now we're kind of understanding that a lot of those things and theories that we had probably weren't happening, but we need to still take some of the, I guess, the way in which they did it with us and kind of continue forward with that, which kind of leads to the question of manual therapy and it being specific, because the narrative was, it has to be this way and this position, and you have to apply this amount of force. What does the kind of research say on the specificity of manual therapy and when it matters and kind of when it doesn't?
Yeah, so there's actually several studies that have looked at it, and both for manipulation. I think there are 9 studies for manipulation, and then for mobilization, I believe there are 6. And in every single one, it is shown that the average treatment effects of a specific group are the same as the average treatment effects of a non-specific group, suggesting that no particular group is superior to the other. Now, as you know, with manual therapy, you've spent a lot of time with the psychomotor skills of learning very specific approaches. Now, within those groups, right, there are some people who do very well with a specific approach, and then some people who don't necessarily do that well with a specific approach. And there's kind of a widespread along those average treatment effects. It's not very consistent. And the way that I try to explain this to a student when I'm spending some time and teaching them on a technique, I'll say, not everybody is going to need this specific of a technique, but that rare occasion where somebody might, you're going to know how to do it. And so because in that group, some people really do benefit. And it seems like the cervical spine is definitely an area where specificity is more important than a lot of the other areas of the body. But indeed, specificity hasn't held up. And in every study that I'm aware of, it doesn't have to be specific.
And I've heard you speak as well about the argument to that would then go, well, great, doesn't have to be specific. That means anybody on earth can do it, massage therapists can do it, and we should just be referring on to them. But in your opinion, it seems pretty valid that we shouldn't just be saying that everybody can do it, because there is training and there's safety and there is specifics to it. It's just potentially not as specific as what we were thinking. Like, do you still think there is a place for manual therapy courses and ideas and I guess teaching of safety and that kind of thing?
Yeah, so, and what I've been on record as saying is that it helps remove the elitism, I think, to manual therapy, which was very, I think, very strong. And I was once in a podcast with Jared Powell and Adam Meekins, and that was something that we all three agreed with, is that there was some pretty heavy elitism there, and it turned a lot of people off. So that part can go away, because anybody can train up and do these particular techniques. I think the way that I think the other thing that it does is it makes us think that how should that training look? How should it be different than spending all the time learning very specific techniques? Should there be a laterality of thinking that goes into that? In other words, how can we do this so that it's safe? How can we do this to get a patient buy-in? What's the best way to make sure that we have the right candidate? How can we make sure that this transitions into an active approach, and the patient's actually working with us on our particular endeavor? I think those skills, which weren't normally taught in manual therapy, I think they're probably as important as the specificity of the manual therapy.
Yeah. And one thing I think all courses need, and especially on social media, is the narrative that goes along with any type of therapy, whether it be exercise or any kind of pain modulating, manual therapy, dry needling, acupuncture. It seems to be, and my bias, which we're going to talk about a little bit as well, is where I got caught as a young clinician, is putting so much stock in the psychological approach and thinking, yes, this is all that we need. This is the new thing that people need to understand. But as we're going to talk about, and as the research says, it doesn't seem to be outperforming everything else that we were already doing. So I guess when it comes to manual therapy and the narrative, and I think that's the frustration that most people have. We've all seen patients that have told, in my world, it's, your flat feet are the problem, your internal rotation's a problem, your misaligned hips is a problem, your limb length difference is a problem. And we're going to be able to fix that out with manual therapy. How would you give advice to people, and I guess clinicians, to explain what manual therapy is and kind of how it's working, and I guess the narrative?
So I try to surround it differently than certainly what I used to. One of the things what I do is I recommend people to stay away from talking about malalignments and many of the traditional things that historically different clinicians who use manual therapy have used. I think those can lead a person down the wrong road as far as what they think is wrong with them, and they also will it will very much externalize the need of receiving care from somebody else. I do recommend that people learn what the mechanisms of manual therapy are. And there is a lot of literature on this. There are well over 1,000 basic science studies that suggest here's what happens physiologically, here's what happens biomechanically, and here's what happens psychologically. There are consistent things that happen in the body, and you can keep it very brief. Patients don't want a dissertation on this, but just to let them know that there is science to support this particular approach, tends to be anti-inflammatory. By all means, it's more analgesic than anything. It's almost like we're doing an ibuprofen treatment with you with the pain analgesia that you'll receive from that.
Oh, that's a good one.
I
I
talk a
like
lot
that one.
about that. Yeah, it very much. I mean, I've even said that before. It's the ibuprofen of a physical therapy treatment. I also talk about the fact that we blend this in with approaches they can do so they can self-manage and so that they can take this and treat themselves. I will have them actually take a lot of what we do in the clinic, learn how to do it to themselves as a home exercise program so that there's carryover with that. So my explanations are really more grounded around that. Very simple, straightforward. We're going to get you moving. We're going to decrease your pain, and hopefully this increase your strength and endurance.
What would you say, and I'm going to talk about a couple of examples I had this week, when, because there's always lots of things to address whenever you're with the person. You want them to understand what's happening to them, what they can and kind of what they can't do, the general prognosis, and there's just lots of things to always talk about. When you're, let's say you're doing some manual therapy or any kind of touch care, and someone says, can you feel that joint out of place, or can you feel that muscle, or oh, you must have massaged that, that knot or that tear out, or something that's probably what we would think is harmful for them. Do you spend time breaking that down or addressing that, or trying to help them understand why that's not the case? Or do you kind of shift your focus and put stock in the other things that you think are going to be more beneficial? Because I know it's a real common occurrence for people to have patients say that to us. And we know that it's like, I don't want people to think that their knee's out of place if I've just done some manual therapy around the knee or through their foot. But there's more things that I need to focus on other than just that. So what kind of advice do you have for people there?
I toe a very kind line on that because I don't, especially on that first encounter with the patient or an early encounter with the patient, I don't want to derail our relationship by telling them that they're wrong and that their thoughts are faulty. I might say something like, the studies have actually shown that what we feel with our hands can be misleading. So I'm very much going to communicate with you as we do this. What you tell me and what happens from that is going to actually be more important than what I feel or what we theoretically think. So it's almost retraining people to work with you in that process and think less about correcting some sort of fault or malalignment. I don't use language like that. I don't tell somebody, hey, do you feel this? This feels out of place. I do, in casual conversation, talk about the fact that asymmetry is actually more normal than symmetry, and that everybody has some abnormalities. I will do the little trick where I'll tell them if they're right or left-handed based on positioning the shoulder and the spine and everything. So, you know, these are asymmetries that are normal just based on the way people move and their handedness. So I try to divorce them from thinking that way, but it's more of a slow drip than it is an attack.
I like that, the slow divorce. Just let it fizzle out a little bit towards the end. That's good. Now, one of the, I feel like I say this every single time for a question, but one thing that I really love that you said, which was a real challenge for me, because I talk a lot about, you know, pain science and education, and I guess the one that you termed the psychological revolution. I was a really big believer, and I was actually speaking to a colleague, Nikki Manville, about this yesterday. I was a big believer in the words that I say and the things that I do is really going to influence someone's self-efficacy. And I've heard you say that that is a really challenging thing to do on the real patient practitioner level. And I guess the question of, does manual therapy lead to patient reliance and lower self-efficacy if it's done, you know, continuously? And it probably doesn't, because we're not really able to influence health efficacy as much as what we think. It's very difficult to change. That's a lot of social norms and health policy. What are your kind of thoughts and opinions on that?
Yeah, so they've actually changed a little bit from, because I think the first podcast that I had mentioned that was about 6 years ago. Mm. And interestingly enough, two psychologists reached out to me and they said, do you know you can change self-efficacy with a treatment? They mentioned it isn't typically quick. Mm. If you have them long enough and you build that relationship with them and they commit, they said typically the self-efficacy improves. You don't see a lot where the self-efficacy actually declines. And it's probably worth mentioning too that when we talk about this, it's often we're talking more about health self-efficacy.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a person's cognitive ability, motivation, lack of apathy to actually make a change and commit to this. And those who lack that health self-efficacy really don't go down the road where they assume a lot of the responsibility of the health-related needs that they do. So looking at or listening to the psychologists, and these are two people I really respect, I went in and dug a little bit further into the literature, because I had never found a single paper that said that manual therapy actually led to lower self-efficacy or health self-efficacy. I found a nice narrative overview that's out of 2018 from Chiropractic and Manual Therapies. And the authors talk about the potential of leading to lower health self-efficacy if you tell them a bunch of nonsense or get them to catastrophize or get fearful that if they don't receive this care, that could lead to all kinds of trauma or bad things. But they also said it probably was balanced out by the hands-on bondedness that they create, that relationship they create with their patients. And again, even the references they had were not direct studies that actually looked at this. To my knowledge today, there's still not a study that shows that there's a decline in health self-efficacy with the use of manual therapy.
Mm, and it's probably a result, because we've all seen the patient that's had a really bad experience and been told some absolute whoppers, and you can just tell they're a little bit down about all the asymmetries and things wrong with them. So I guess that can influence how we think about it just generally, but it's nice to hear there isn't any research on it. Of course, it doesn't mean that there wouldn't be some in the next 5 to 10 years, but at this stage, it doesn't seem to be any, which is nice to hear.
You know, Blake, I would argue too, that's a management approach issue more so than a manual therapy issue. I think manual therapy is just an intervention, right? Mm. But if you're managing patients the wrong way and you're telling them the wrong things and you're doing things to assure that you can see this patient 30 times or keep them, you know, on the hook or something like that, then that's a management issue. And I think you can do this, you can make that mistake as well with psychologically informed care, and you know they can linger their patients along for a very long period of time too. I think it's, you know, all of those elements need to be looked at.
Yeah, I guess every every gripe we have with manual therapy is the same you could have with any kind of tear. I remember an interesting discussion. We're talking about, sorry, you were talking about, if massage therapy, sorry, if patients were seeing us as PTs for, say, massage, we would just then refer them out for massage because it's pretty easy to do. Well, the same argument could be said then. Well, then should we just be referring out to PTs for exercise because the outcomes are generally the same and all the problems we have in manual therapy are the same with exercise as well, which we all seem to really like.
There are, and again, we have no silver bullet treatments. So, it basically boils down a lot to patient preferences and capacity. Some people aren't going to have the ability to do what we ask them to do. So, a lot of it is going to be, we do our best, right? We do our best to match the right care for the right patient. But to date, we still don't have really strong algorithms to tailor care in the best way. We are just dipping our toe in the precision medicine water. We still have a long way to go.
I was pretty disappointed to hear you say we didn't have the silver bullet. So I'm hoping you have the silver bullet for this question because this is easiest the most thing that I struggle with in all of my practitioner, I guess, patient relationship is just the communication and helping people understand what's happening to them, what we can do about it, and I guess the treatment journey until they're not going to be seeing me, and it all comes down to I guess behavior change and. Hearing you speak about how health policy and social norms, which are different between obviously each country, plays a really big determinant role in someone's ability to get better. And I've heard before around some of the outcome measures that we talk about, even just I think it was the societal norms, is like 20 to 25% of the outcome is related to that. And it's only a small percent of actually what we do as practitioners, which can be a little bit disheartening because I'd like to think we're better than that. But it's good to level out a little bit. And I guess a lot of the positives you want to see and advocate for with our patients are just the more likely to be a result of that rather than what we do. And I guess could you speak to that and see what do you see the health professionals' role other than helping patients with pain and function? Can we change their life for the better if we kind of know what they need to do? And can you please give me the silver bullet on how to do that in one sentence?
Well, in one sentence, probably not. No, I think you did a nice summary of some of the challenges that we deal with because a person's health, their health status, is so significantly influenced by factors that are outside our control. And you're probably referencing McManus's data, where he said about 20% of the overall health of an individual is associated with the clinical care they receive. And then there's social components, there's environmental components, and there are behavioral components. And all of those are often very influenced by the environment that they're in, their socioeconomic status, their cognitive status, their apathy level, their commitment to change, all of these things, which are often external to our ability to moderate in the time that we have with our clinic. Now, I've done a lot of research in this. We've done research on social risks. And what social risks do is it creates a kind of a glass ceiling on a person's health and recovery. And what we've noticed is they are consistently, those individuals with two or more social determinants of health risks will have 20% lower overall health outcomes despite receiving the same interventions. So whether that's surgery or a conservative care option or something of that nature. And that is really worth noting. Now, can we do anything about that? Well, it's probably going to take three things, I think. First of all, that individual clinician needs to know what services are available in their surrounding area and be willing and able to refer those individuals to those services. If it's food insecurity, if it's health access, if it's crime, if it's housing, all of those things can be done externally, which we don't do, right? It needs to be systems level. So hospital system or health-related system, they need to step in and create services that allow to help that person process through that care route, especially if it's something invasive like surgery. They need to be there. I call it like having a little angel on their shoulder to make sure that they go to their appointments, they do the things they need to do. There's not this black box of no care after surgery. And the third level, which is probably the most important, which is difficult for us other than being advocates, that's at the public health level. And we need to vote for representatives that will help in taking care of individuals who have social risks. We need to change policies, and we need to study the most effective way to do this. Blake, as you know, we're very good at pointing out problems. We do that exceptionally well. You know, you've mentioned psychologically informed practice. We're really good at identifying psychological risks with our patients. What we're not that good at is fixing the problem. And it's the same so far. There's some doesn't seem to be a really good model for fixing these social risks. And I apologize for going long on that, but it is a complicated topic.
No, that's good. That's what I wanted to hear. You articulated a lot better than me, but exactly the same thoughts. And it's that ability to communicate on that first level that I guess it just takes a lot of time. And a lot of the things I speak about with the students and younger clinicians is that ability to meet the person that you're with where they are, and everyone's going to be on at a different level is very, very difficult. And that communication just takes time. And I've heard you talk about a really cool study they did over in the States with it was maybe 50 or 100,000 clinicians, and they looked at who maybe got the best outcomes, and it was the person that was able to adapt their treatment to the person in front of them compared to the person that was really rigid of like, it's this or nothing.
So that's Adam Lutz's work. And I'm very fond, I'm quite jealous of his study. It's a great study. They looked at treatment signatures, and they looked at which clinicians had the worst outcomes and which clinicians had the best outcomes. Now, interestingly enough, they found that about 80% of clinicians all had about the same outcomes. And they typically had typical treatment signatures, you know, just a cacophony of different treatments that they used. Those who had the worst outcomes tended to only use active treatments, and they did not adapt to the patient. So as that patient came in and their pain levels or function levels wax and wane like they always do, they just kept going with the status quo and kept with the same exercise program. Those had the worst outcomes. The best outcomes were those who actually adapted their care. So they adjusted what they did in that treatment visit, depending on how that patient was doing. And they also had higher percentages of manual therapy that they used in those particular cases. Now, that's pretty powerful because it shows what a better treatment signature is. Dan Ron's group in the military has shown something similar, and that just came out about a month ago. So we've commonly kind of thrown manual therapy in to this passive care group and called it low-value care. It's not what the studies are suggesting. If you actually look at the data, it suggests that it kind of leads to higher value care and better outcomes.
Yeah, and on that topic, when you seem to compare it against everything else, which it's always, which is very frustrating, but it is always exercise versus manual therapy. I don't really ever see it being one way or the other, but as you've said multiple times in the literature, it seems to be about the same, which is almost every treatment that we do has generally roughly about the same outcome. But can you speak to the outcome purely, I guess, of pain and function, but also the cost effectiveness of manual therapy versus other treatments?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, I think we need to widen our idea of what an outcome should be, right? There's always pain and function. Those are consistently recommended. You know, I have concerns about recurrence. I have concerns about costs. They should be included in that mix. You know, I think we need to be thinking more broadly about what are the outcomes and what do they actually do. They tend to be about the same across the board. So regardless of what treatment approach, and then even within the treatment mechanisms themselves, John Burns' really beautiful paper last year showed that four different psychologically informed cognitive behavioral therapy approaches all had the exact same outcome. They basically did the same thing. If you see different exercises compared, they tend to have the same outcome. There doesn't seem to be a superior form of manual therapy. They all have similar outcomes. And then if you lump all these together and compare them, you know, this one to that one, they all tend to have the same outcomes. Cost effectiveness wise, there seems to be a little bit of a separation. There are many cost effectiveness studies in manual therapy. I know of more than a dozen, and they consistently show equal or more cost effective outcomes in comparison to things such as usual care, which can be a lot of different things, in comparison to GP practice, in comparison to medications, tends to be very similar overall to exercise. It is superior in some cases to exercise, and it seems to be superior too to psychologically informed practice, which just takes a little bit more time, I think, to really build that out on a patient, and that might be why. There are two types of cost effectiveness, and I know you know this, but this is more for your listeners, I think. There's just overall costs, and certainly that kind of cheats the more expensive interventions that may make a bigger difference in the health outcomes, like surgery. And then there's cost effectiveness ratios, and that actually takes the cost and divides it by how much of an outcome change you get. And then you can actually look and see, yeah, I know it was more expensive, but was it worth it since we saw a bigger change in the outcome? So cost effectiveness ratio is a better measure because it takes into account how much of a change there is for the cost. And manual therapy does actually very well with that. And again, that probably shocks a lot of people because, you know, kind of the word on the street was that it's low value care. And that's just not what the data support.
Yeah, well, where do you think that comes from? Like, it seems pretty clear. I mean, I've got to admit, I don't think I've had seen. Oh, sorry, I don't think I've heard you say an answer without drawing on studies. You've read a lot of studies in your time, definitely. Like, where do you think that idea comes from?
There was a paper in 2006 where they actually looked at the percentages of active versus passive care. It was a retrospective study, and I think I have my dates right. I think it was 2006. It was Fritz Brennan and Cleland, three wonderful researchers and good friends. And they basically took data that already existed and they did an arbitrary 75% cutoff. They said care should be 75% active and no more than 25% passive. And they looked at individuals. They looked at over 1,100 subjects, and they divided them into two groups. And they said this one's either passive or this one was either active. And so they didn't experimentally divide them or anything like that. And they found there was a pretty substantial difference, that the active folks did quite a bit better with their health outcomes. Their costs were better, and you know, a number of other things. The problem was, is if you looked at the baseline characteristics, these were two completely different groups. The people had more pain, they were sicker, they were older, they had more problems, more comorbidities that were in the passive group. And most likely, the reason they were receiving passive care by the clinicians was because of their difference in their overall clinical state. So it started back then. I think that kind of spawned a few similar types of studies that came out where they were retrospective and kind of went from there. But I spoke on this in Belgium and Sweden, and I actually talked about the number. There are many studies that have compared active versus passive. And interestingly, the research is mixed. There are studies that actually show that passive does better than active in some cases. There's one study on OA of the knee where they found tens to be the most cost-effective intervention. Tens
Yeah,
doesn't get
tense.
much more passive than that.
Damn, tense stock's going to go up right after this podcast.
But I will say this, it's not the clear picture that we had assumed it was. I am somewhat optimistic that the most recent consensus development statements and panels that have come out on value-based care, there's no mention whatsoever of passive versus active. I think the panel is smart enough to realize that that's a mistake to go down that road, that isn't the direction we need to go. Instead, they dwell more in on patient-centered care and autonomy of care and making sure the patient can self-manage.
Do you think one of the reasons that exercise therapy perhaps doesn't hold up as well is because the compliance rates are so low with people sticking to a program? And I've stalked your Twitter, as I'm sure many people have, and I saw you put up a slide. It was around like 50% of people had dropped out or a certain number of times. It was only a really short period of time. If exercise has I guess, the secondary benefits of bridging deficits, helping get back to people what they want to be able to do if they currently can't do that, Do you think that it would perform any better if people were able to be more compliant through the time that we're recommending? Then the follow-up question to that, which I'm praying to the physical therapy gods, you've got another silver bullet answer for me. How do we help people stay more compliant with their rehab and exercise, and I guess, yeah, everything that we want them to do and what we're recommending?
So if you ask the clinician in me, do I think it would make a difference if they stayed compliant, if they were adherent to their program? My answer is yes. I think it would make a difference. But I think there are two caveats there. The first one is we need to make sure that that home exercise program is meaningful and has high fidelity. And right now we throw a lot of garbage home exercise programs at patient. Last year we published a paper. The first author is named Per Himmler. And Himmler found that, and what we did is we basically, it was a qualitative study. We asked patients why they weren't doing their home exercise programs. And there were two main themes. The first one was is they didn't really make sense to them. The program that was assigned, they didn't think it was applicable to their condition. And the second one was it did not modulate their pain. And that was very meaningful to have some form of home program that actually touched their pain somewhat. And
Interesting.
it was to them, it was a measure of applicability. So if those things were tagged, right? If we did something that was meaningful, that we were modulating their pain, if they would continue with it, then yes, I think it should make a difference. However, most of the studies that show that currently study this and they look at adherence rates, it does not seem to affect health outcomes. It does not seem to affect those long-term outcomes. And it may be the way that we're measuring adherence. I think it might be. I mean, some of the ways that we measure it are pretty sketchy. They're asking PTs, you know, was the patient adherent or not? I don't think that's very accurate. But it could be the way we're measuring it, or it could be, like many of the studies, it's just that home exercise programs that were assigned just weren't that good and meaningful.
So you're saying that like some of the research is explaining that the more compliant someone is, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's this linear relationship where their outcomes are better as a result.
That is correct. And often what you see, and I think what I tweeted out was a study that found that over 50% of people, as soon as their symptoms resolve, they stop doing their home exercise program. Even if it's a strengthening related program or a behavioral based program or an aerobic based program, they just stop doing it. And so they're going to lose those benefits. And it's very, very common and very difficult to get people to stay on task, I think, with those.
And I guess that comes back to the just saying that the communication, something I've been a big advocate for in the last couple of years, is I'm a real big believer in resistance training. Not just for the fact of, you know, getting big muscles, but the evidence seems to be pretty clear. The benefits for, you know, health markers, blood markers, your bone health, your tendon health. And to be honest, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that most people should be doing some form of resistance training. We know the research says you really don't have to do as much as what we thought. The minimum effective dose is pretty small, but still the most challenging thing is having people understand why that is beneficial for them. And there's a, I guess one of the reasons or one way to potentially do that is to give people lots of different options to be able to do that. And it comes back to the idea of, you know, giving people what they want, not what they need. And I guess, do we need to have lots of different options so people have better compliance and better understanding? Or can we purely just rely on our communication skills? Like if we are really that good at having someone understand what they're doing, do we need to rely on much else? Because if they're involved, and I guess that comes back to the buy-in, they're going to do it. Or is it all about having as many options, kind of letting them choose and then guiding them where we think they need to go?
So, first of all, I want to comment on your earlier statement that you think people should do resistance training, and I completely agree. And because I do think physiologically there is strong evidence that it makes a difference. We've got a paper that in review right now, and there are hundreds of papers that show this, that inflammatory and immunologic biomarkers tend to react very favorably with exercise, especially resistance exercise. Whereas if you look at the same types of studies with manual therapy, it's either unknown or it has a less effect. So something else is happening with manual therapy other than just what is happening with exercise. again, that's in review, so we hope that comes out pretty soon. But that is very much, you know, a check on the box of resistance exercise is important. I hate to give you a soft answer, but I think one of the challenges that we need to acknowledge is that we're going to have some failures with our patients. And that's not on us. It could potentially be on them. And that's because any type of communication, right? You have a sender and a receiver. And sometimes the receiver is not receiving that information. They're not going to behaviorally change and do the things necessary to adopt that. Or maybe they truly are in a situation where they can't. Maybe they work two jobs or they have kids and they're a single parent, or, you know, and they just can't buy in the time to make this worthwhile. And I think that's subject dependent. So we do our best on those. We communicate the best way we can. We give them all the resources we can. But we recognize that in some cases, it's just not going to happen. And that's I don't think that based on the system that we're in, which I think is a very reactive system, I'm not sure that's all our fault on that. I think it's more of a system issue.
With the rates of kind of chronic and persistent pain increasing, unfortunately, and I guess us as health providers becoming very much in want, do you think that we're getting better as a profession all over the world with, I mean, if you were to look at if we're getting better and then correlating with that is are people generally performing better and having less pain, it wouldn't be the case. Like, do you think that we're improving, but it's just there's other factors that are influencing the increasing rate of chronic pain, the increasing rate of osteoarthritis, all these types of other disabling musculoskeletal conditions?
Yeah, I'm going to answer it though in my opinion only, mainly because I'm trying to stay within my lane on, you know, what I know. I think as care providers, we are better than what we've ever been. I do think that we continue to ascend in our knowledge and our ability to recognize things and prescribe things that are meaningful. I do think that piece has gotten better. I do think it's external elements that are influencing what we've seen globally. I can't completely explain it. I have some ideas, but I think a lazy argument is always pointing the finger at the health providers and saying they need to do better. I think it's other factors that have probably been the primary reason.
Yeah. I say last 5 to 10 years, because that's since I've been practicing, and a lot of social media, I guess, has shaped how I've thought about language and communication, purely not just from listening to people, but people posting studies and you going to read them and understanding different people have different ideas. But the idea of this psychological revolution and pain science and pain neuroscience was thought to be the thing that's going to really help people. And there was a time in my career, which I'm very open to say, that I used to think of it like a treatment. Like, I would just give someone pain science, you would get better, you understand what's happening to you, your pain goes away. And it's quite naive to think, and I can't believe I used to think like that, but I'm sure some people have made that leap as well, and it's nothing like that. Do you think it leads to better outcomes? Because I've seen plenty of studies, and I'm actually presenting on one next month, that looked at kind of pain science and exercise versus for Achilles tendinopathy versus more of a biomechanical approach to explaining what's happening in exercise, and there was no difference in outcomes at all. What are your kind of thoughts and opinions on that? Is it the fact that we just haven't gotten as good as probably what we need to at it, or it's really just as good as everything else that we can say?
So I can talk a lot about this. I actually did additional study in this particular area because I felt it was a fault of my or a weakness of mine. So I did a 2.5 year certificate program around this area. And then I did more informal study. And we've also done a number of studies where we've actually compared behavioral interventions to others. So I feel pretty strong about this area. I work with really smart psychologists who frequently tell us, you're the perfect people to do the psychologically informed practice, not just based on the communication skills, but because you can put your hands on people and move people and have them do things in addition. That's where the real value is. And these are psychologists that are saying that. As you stated, this has not been the panacea that we had hoped, right? And the outcomes aren't really a whole lot different than everything that they thought it was going to replace, right? Passive interventions, active interventions. That said, do I think it still has a value? Yeah, I think we should learn the psychologically informed approaches. I think we should learn communication skills. I do think there is that upper 10% who have an amazing skill set in their ability to communicate with the patient and really drill in. If you've ever seen Peter O'Sullivan communicate with a patient, Mike Stewart's that way too, out of the UK. If you've ever seen him interact, it is they just have a gift, and that gift is going to lead to changes. Not everybody has that gift. If you look at the data, the research on it, it does seem to do a couple of things. It does have some effect on pain, and it has some effect on a person's ability to socially engage. So it gets people back into things they used to do more. Those are wins, I think. Function-wise, it's probably no better than an exercise approach or a manual therapy approach. It doesn't probably, us doing this and not a clinically trained psychologist, probably not going to see huge changes in anxiety or clinical depression and things like that. We shouldn't expect those things. That's kind of outside our bounds. But yeah, it's interesting because I think everybody thought this thing was really going to be the game changer. And it's great. It's a great addition, but I wouldn't call it a game changer.
Yeah, I was in that camp, and I guess the when we I always think about it myself, and I think in the probably the last 6 to 12 months, I've almost gone so far the other way that it was almost hard for me to communicate sometimes because I was so concerned about, like, I don't want you to think anything harmful about your foot posture or your knee valgus or anything that's happening within your body. And referencing studies of, there's plenty in the lumbar spine where, you say load related change or age related change instead of degenerative change or impingement and things like that. It's very hard to see the outcome as a clinician because if I tell someone that they're flat foot posture is within the normal variance and we shouldn't be too concerned versus it's the sole cause of their heel pain, it's hard for me to be able to gauge an outcome because I don't know which one is kind of better other than just what I've read from the research. Do you think that it is better, I guess, or can we measure the outcomes, or is it purely just better from what we think that people should think about their own bodies when we use our language in different ways?
Yeah, I don't know the literature well enough to talk about if it really influences outcomes a lot. You may know it more than I do. I think it's still good practice to adopt, cleaner language and less fearful or catastrophizing language. If would it surprise me if, a direct comparison came out and there was no difference? Not a bit. Wouldn't surprise me a bit. I think these are small pieces. Mark Hancock, who is, I think, in Australia, just a really good thinker, told me one time, small victories, if you can compound those small victories, it ends up being a bigger victory. So, small things sometimes are additive. But I don't think it makes that big of a difference. Yeah. And, you mentioned, we used to just blast people with pain science too. And we had
Yeah,
a recent
guilty, guilty.
we had a recent trial where that was part of the care. I mean, it was a six visit cognitive behavioral approach, and one full visit was just going into, pain science and understanding what it was and what it means to them and not to be fearful of it. And we saw so many glassy-eyed people and,
Don't
folks
tell
who
me, I'm
just
going to block my ears. Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. Yeah. And w so th was that compared against something, or that was just to see what the outcomes were?
Yeah, it was a study we did compare it. It's called the PERC trial, and it was patients with shoulder impingement syndrome. And what we did is we compared a
Oh, yes.
both groups received physical therapy, and then one group received a really intensive cognitive behavioral approach as an add-on treatment. Provided no additional value whatsoever. The PT approach in both groups was so good, and there was such a dramatic change that, we just didn't see any value to it.
It makes so much sense. I mean, for someone that if you've ever been in pain, it makes so much sense that you whenever you've got knee pain or foot pain or hip pain yourself, you obviously want to know what's going on, but you want to know that you're not doing anything wrong. And as a clinician, It just makes so much sense to me that I think it would be beneficial for that person to know that their knee potentially isn't bone on bone. It's these changes that are happening. Like that could just mean so much for their long term of do they go and do park run or do they go and play with their family? They're not concerned and scared of their knee. But perhaps we just can't say that too clearly yet, even though it may be pragmatic or logical to think about.
We recently have done some prognostic work, and we've gone to the patients and say, what do you really want to know? And one of the things that really resonated to me was they said, no offense to you all, but you're kind of like a car mechanic. When I go to you, I want you to tell me what's wrong and how much time I got and what I need to do. Because it's Greek to me. I'm not going to understand much of it. So if you can frame it in a way that it's simplistic and understandable, and I kind of know what I need to do, then problem solved. And so I started thinking about that more so, and less about being some educator blasting them with, complex information, but keeping the example simple and straightforward and saying, you're going to be fine. First of all, you're going to be fine. All right. Here are some of the things you might want to watch doing. Here are the things you can absolutely do and you should do. And that's what they want to know.
Gone are the days where I'm drawing peripheral nerves up on my whiteboard when people just want to know if they can go for a run. I think back to think, God, that must have been boring. I had a couple of questions, or we had more than a couple of questions coming on the social media, just asking, because I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but why do you think manual therapy, or more specific manual therapy, seems to be beneficial in the neck compared to other parts of the body, hips, knees, back, that kind of thing?
So I'm going to answer it with honesty. I don't know. But I mean, I really don't, because if you look at the mechanisms research, it's very consistent. You see consistency throughout the body of what happens physiologically. I've noticed it too as a clinician. I mean, if you give me the opportunity to work, if you say you're going to have to use manual therapy with your patient, you can either see a patient with a neck problem or a back problem. I'd say, give me the neck problem because I think it's better. It would just works better there. So I wish I could tell you, but I honestly don't know.
And for your clinical practice and what you know, if we're talking, I guess the average here in Australia is an hour initial and a 30-minute follow-up. How much time, and I know it depends, of course, with every person, but how much time do you dedicate, to pure manual therapy? Are you getting your education in during that, or are you focusing more on in the first few consults of explaining what's happening, what they can do, and really spending that time educating, or are you doing a bit of both, or focusing more one on the other?
I always do both. And that's, when people, it's weird because I don't really understand the question when someone asks me, do you use manual therapy first and then transition to active? I'm like, no, I do them both. And I've always done them both. The percentages will change a little bit based on, patient presentation. But if we had to throw a time on it, maybe a fourth to a third of the time doing a manual therapy thing and then a full, the rest of the time being more active and showing them how to move themselves and show them very complementary movements to what we did with manual therapy. So they know that they have ownership in doing something very similar and they can do this at home. Talking about the fact that, hey, you're only going to see me like once a week and all this extra time, you can be doing things for yourself. Here's what you need to do. Spending a lot of time on that part of it too. So not a ton of time, but I think patients expect manual therapy somewhat. There's a really lovely paper by Mark Thomas out of the UK in 2022, I think, that showed that patients indeed, it's a systematic review, they expected it. And then there is an osteopathic journal paper that also showed that patients who go to osteopaths, even in the United States, where they're very much considered just like a medical physician, patients still expect hands-on care. So, it's part of it is matching expectations, but the other part of it is I do think there's a lot of power in pain modulating, and in many cases you can have success with that.
You just read my mind, 'cause I was just about to ask, is one of the most powerful things the fact that someone can see that we can influence their pain in a pretty short period of time, and then hopefully as a long-term solution, they can influence their own pain at home and so forth.
Well, as a clinician, I know you've had patients that maybe just started crying spontaneously because you're the very first person that has, first of all, identified their pain or reproduced it and then modulated it. And I do think that's an incredibly powerful thing. And as a, I'm a former triathlete, had a knee problem and did the whole bounce around to all the practitioners thing. And everybody's doing the same special tests and two sets of images and all this other stuff and nothing, no one time could touch my pain. And I went to a master clinician and he went in and he moved my knee a certain way. And he said, "Is that your pain?" And I said, "Yes." And that was so powerful to me because I said, okay, somebody knows what they're doing. And then he was able to modulate it and taught me how to self-modulate it as, in a home program. Those things are really powerful and really, really powerful for those people who are frustrated and haven't seen success.
Yeah, I did triathlon for three or four years. What was your favorite discipline? I take you more of as a maybe a biker, a cyclist.
Oh yeah, I was a cyclist.
Oh, yeah. You can see that in the aero position, riding fast.
Yeah.
When, you know, talking about, you know, as you were saying, just seeing that clinician, how important do you think, and what does the research say on patients needing a specific diagnosis? And as you would be aware of all the research in non-specific lower back pain, in my world, it's not plantar fasciitis, it's plantar heel pain, or we don't really know the driver of the pain. Do you think it matters so much for people? I would say clinically for me, I don't think it does as much as what I thought it did, but perhaps it does for the patients. I'm certainly not asking them if they need a diagnosis, but how much do you think that matters? And I guess it matters more for some or for less, but generally on a scale.
I think patients want it. I think clinicians have worked into this vague world for so long that it no longer means very much to us. So I've kind of lived in the world of endotypes now with patients. And instead of having, you know, non-specific low back pain and using that language with a patient, I can say that there are many sub-variants. And it appears that, you know, we're dealing with this with you. It is still non-specific low back pain, but, you know, essentially here are the components of it that seem to be reflective of your condition. I think they appreciate that. I think they get frustrated without, you know, I think they get very frustrated if you just use terms like non-specific or, you know, we don't know what tissue is involved in your case or any of those things. I think patients need that. In the world of precision medicine, I think we have a long way to go to before we understand disease mechanisms. And until we understand disease mechanisms, and I think we're getting good at these, right? With tendinopathy, I think we've really made some strides in that area. I think even in osteoarthritis, we've made some strides. But in other conditions, we don't understand the disease mechanisms very well. We don't really know what's going on. And wow, that really puts us behind the eight ball, I think, in some cases.
Yeah, I do know a guy on social media. He's got 50,000 followers. He, I think he knows all the disease mechanisms. He's able to find the root cause. Just sampled up a couple of stories, but that's good. Now, for people that want to be able to find you, I mean, it's pretty easy if you just type in your name and PubMed. You've been authored and co-authored on a lot of studies. But you mentioned you're active on X. Is that where people can go and find you, or what's the best way to kind of keep up with what you're doing?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn, which I'm still trying to figure out what that platform is about, but I'm on LinkedIn. I have more followers on X than anything. I will say this, I have turned all my notifications off. So people have said, "Hey, I tried to directly contact you," or I tweeted at you, or whatever it's called now. I don't know it because I closed all the notifications. So I don't hear any, I don't see any responses. I don't see all the bad stuff that people are saying about me anymore, and it's really wonderful.
yeah. Just put it out there, let them deal with it, and then come back a couple of weeks later. It's pretty bad, like you were saying. I mean, what's your kind of experiences as someone that's very well known and very well respected? I mean, even for someone like you to put out a very non-direct statement, just of a research study, that you just get basically attacked for anything that you do or say. It must be hard to deal with. I know a lot of young clinicians are very scared of social media just because they don't want to say anything because it's going to get attacked, which isn't that good, because it's almost this war of ideas where the other person always wins because they're louder, or they've got more followers, or they just use all caps or something like that in their reply.
So you just summed up 90% of what I think. And the only thing I would add is I don't need to justify that individual's existence. I don't need to give them a platform if they don't deserve a platform. And you don't owe anybody a response. So that's one of the reasons I have just stepped away. I will still push my studies and say, hey, you may want to consider reading this one, or this is a really good article. This one may answer a question, but I don't respond. And the trolls don't exist if you don't respond to them and you don't read them. And I don't read any of it. I don't follow them. And I'm a free speech guy, a big time libertarian, big free speech person. You know, people can say whatever they want, but in the same token, you don't have to listen to it. And I've chosen not to listen.
Yeah, there's some pretty horrible opinions getting around this as well
Pretty
from people that
mean.
aren't clinicians either. I'm like, have you? There's plenty of research. Surely you've read this, but no. So to follow you on LinkedIn's the one. I guess the crash course on LinkedIn is anytime you do anything that's remotely good. Like if you get out of bed in the morning, you write this big paragraph and say, "Hey, I got out. I summoned the courage and I got out of bed and I did it." And people will like that one. And then to follow you on X is where studies and your ideas and things, and also you're sharing other people's research as well, which I've seen, like other people's things that you think people should read, which is awesome to see.
Yep, those are the two best places, I think.
Yeah, beautiful. And then are you doing any speaking or anything this year or in the coming years or anything like that? Or you're focused more academia, getting some things done? Can people come and find you or see you anywhere?
Yeah, so I'm very lucky, get to go to New Zealand, and I'll
Oh, very
have
nice.
several speaking engagements in early March of this year. And then I'm going to IFOMT in Switzerland. I'm speaking twice with a couple of very good colleagues. And I will be also speaking at Combined Sessions in the United States, which is our really big conference, close to 20,000
Oh,
people
wow.
that go to that. And that's going to be in February. So,
Yeah. And are they all conferences, or do you do any courses or anything like that, or that's purely conferences?
I do. There's educational breakouts. They're like
Yeah.
2-hour breakouts to, an audience or something. I do work with an educational company out of the United States if people are interested in educational content, but I don't like to push my stuff. So, but yeah, that there are ways of, of Con Ed courses and stuff like that, that if people look hard enough, they can find it.
Yeah, just remember, New Zealand's not too far from Australia, and we're on the east coast of Newcastle. You could fly in. We could do a triathlon. We could do a little Newcastle one, and then you could fly out.
I
Not too
think I
far
would
away.
drown.
Yeah,
Swimming was my worst event, and I haven't
the
swam for a
beaches have
while.
been
So,
pretty rough here lately too, so I haven't been in there.
yeah, and you have those crazy jellyfish like Eri Kanji and all that. I'm a little concerned about that, so
Yeah,
won't be getting in
we've got
there.
everything over here. We're built different over in Australia, but not to our liking. I mean, I don't want to go running and seeing snakes here, and then I go in the water and there's all these other things that are trying to get me.
Yeah, I think I'll pass, in other words, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Beautiful. Lovely, mate. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate your time and expertise, and enjoy that bottle of whiskey and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
I will. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much, Blake.